What we're going to hear next is really three stories wrapped around each other. The first is something that really happened, a famous lynching in Marion, Indiana, in the summer of 1930. The second is the story of the song Strange Fruit, which was inspired by that lynching. And the third is a new novel, which begins on that terrible day. The novel is called The Evening Road. It's by Laird Hunt, and this is how he came to write it.
6 or 7 years ago, I had NPR on, and there was a story that came on the radio called Strange Fruit, Anniversary of a Lynching.
In August of 1930, a photographer took a picture of two black teenagers hanging by their necks from a tree in the town square of Marion, Indiana. The picture shows the crowd gathered around, pointing at the bodies, some smiling. Today, it's probably the most iconic photograph of lynching in America. After seeing that photograph, a high school teacher in the Bronx named Abel Mirapol wrote a poem, which he set to music. That song, Strange Fruit, was later made famous by Billie Holiday.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves.
The basic event on August 6, 1930, a young white man was shot, and three young black men, one of them was only 16 years old, were arrested for this crime and put into jail in Marion, Indiana. While they were in jail, in the following hours, the young white man died. His name was Claude Dieter. This news spread and turned into a mob situation, and the mob broke into the Marion jail with sledgehammers and took the two older young men out and lynched them. And the third, James Cameron, was spared just at the very last minute. Marion, Indiana is about an hour away from my family's farm in rural Indiana, where I did a lot of my growing up with my grandmother, the two of us in this big rambling farmhouse. And the thing that really struck me was, and I hadn't really thought about it before, was that the lynching had never been mentioned all the years I lived in Indiana. My grandmother was forever talking about her earlier days, and that would have been certainly right in the middle of them.
I can never forget that night.
That NPR radio show that I mentioned, it's really an extraordinary program that has the voice of James Cameron.
I was in there about 3 hours when daylight approached, and they were gathering in small knots of people, 8 to 10 people at a time, and shaking fists up at the jail, and the crowds kept getting bigger and bigger all during the day.
And then people who had attended the event, who were then in their later years, there is a recording in particular of an older woman who describes how she heard about the event.
I came down from the office, and Grendel said, "Where are you going, kiddo?" And I said, "Well, I'm going home. I said, I finished my day's work."
Which was someone, perhaps a colleague, a friend, saying, "You know, you better stick around."
And I said, "Well, what's going on?" I said, "I haven't heard anything." And he said, "Well, they're going to lynch the niggers." And I said, "Oh, Grendel, you're kidding." And he said, "No, I'm not." He said, "You better stick around." So there's going to be some excitement.
And she jumps in the car, and they drive off to Marion together. And that in and of itself was interesting, but it's just her last comment. And she's laughing a little nervously as she says this.
I'd wished 1,000 times I hadn't been so inquisitive.
It was really that stuck with me, because she's not saying this was an awful thing that happened. This was a horrible thing that happened. She's talking about how she wished she hadn't seen it. And you can read all kinds of things into her words. But there was something about that ambivalence at the root of what she was saying that really struck me. And I wanted to explore that.
Well, you tell this story, the story of this day, through the eyes of two different women, Audie Lee Henshaw and Calla Destry, and you write wonderful women characters, strong-minded, strong-willed women with very distinctive voices. And these two are, you know, in your tradition. So tell us about Audie Lee Henshaw. I mean, we meet her on the first page, right? And she's sharpening pencils and fantasizing using them to stab her boss.
That's Audie Lee right there. No question about it. And, you know, so she's the character who grew out of my encounter with that voice on the radio. Of course, she's not that woman. She is very much her own character. And I've been interested in writing the voices of women, stories told by women, for a good little while now. These women I've been moved to write, whose voices have in many ways possessed me, are, to me at least, an interesting blend of a kind of ferocious hunger to encounter the world with all its good and all its bad, to understand it and take a great big bite out of it.
So Audie Lee's boss is the one who tells you there's going to be this lynching and they should go see it. And on the way there, they stop for a catfish supper. This would be a good place to ask you to read a bit, something that kind of gives us a sense.
Yeah, so they have stopped off. They're on their way to the lynching, and they've picked up her husband along the way and decided they're hungry, and they'll get a bite to eat. And as you say, there is a kind of carnival-like atmosphere to the whole proceeding. And everybody at this church supper is aware of the event that's going to happen. So they're sort of stirred up. And one of the main ringleaders in this is this local wannabe politician. "It's a patriotic thing you're doing, madam," he said, and gave a little bow of his head that set his chin flaps to flopping. "Going to the lynching is patriotic? Didn't you hear my speech?" "Some of it." "And how'd you find it, that portion that you heard?" He gave a great big smile and more than I liked of a look at his pink gums. I have never liked someone showed too much gum. I shrugged. The smile fell off his face and into the brown grass. "Was it that bad? You want the truth? I miss most of it." This seemed to perk him up. "But you liked what you heard? A torch of clarity to burn bright across the countryside during dark days. That's got a winner's ring to it, wouldn't you agree? I worked hard on that part." "You said that? About the lynching? The one that's happening today?" "Yes, madam, I did. It's a difficult thing, a harsh thing, but it will burn things clear, bring us back into balance. The hardest things always do." "Well, I'll give it to you," I said. "That part is pretty good." He started to say something else, stopped, sneaked a look down the front of my dress, then showed me his gums again.
Now, one strange note is the word choice you use in the book. Rather than refer to characters as black or white, you came up with cornflower and corn silk. Why?
When I first did the first draft of the novel, it's quite short and it uses the standard racial epithets of the time. And I still have that draft. I printed it out and read through it, and it was so painful to read it using those terms, that terminology. And
because they carry so much weight, so much history?
So much weight, so much history, and it's damaging history.
Mm-hmm.
On that draft, I have crossed out all of those epithets and inserted the word colored. And even that, even though it's period appropriate, just wasn't working for me. And I was casting about, not quite sure how I was going to move forward, and I thought of that word colored, and then I thought of paint colors. And I looked in a paint catalog and came across, I'm not sure if it was corn silk or cornflower first, but they were both in there, colors of paint. And so I swapped the words out, thinking that once I had gone farther with the novel, completed it, I would switch back. But I realized that not only did it help me to write this book, early readers talked about how it helped them to read the book.
So we should talk about your other strong woman character who picks up the story of this day from Audie Lee Henshaw, and this is Calla Destry. Can you tell us about her?
So Calla is in Marion on the day of the lynching. She lives there. She's a teenager. She's black, and she wants to get out of town, right? So there were some people put the number at 10,000 people poured into witnessed this event on that day. And of course, the African-American population either bolted their doors and pulled the shades or got out of town. But her departure is complicated and leads her down many a difficult road.
Calla winds up actually her route takes her through town, and she sees this whole, what she calls it, the death carnival. Could you read a little bit of her description of that?
Sure. None of it was what I had expected. None of it was what I had thought, which was Klan hats and Klan robes and Klan torches and maybe a few ugly corn silk men with bleeding, chaw-filled mouths. No, this was corn silks drinking out of bottles in the bright sunshine, corn silk families reclining in the shade of the killing trees. There were women and babies and little boys juggling apples and bulldogs slobbering and biting at their own tails. This wasn't something away on over there, like a picture show. This was all around. This was right next to me. I drove slow because that's all I could do, and went past a little girl in a green dress who was draped like limp lettuce over her father's shoulder. She gave me a sleepy smile, lifted her little hand, and said hi in a soft voice as I went by, and I rolled up my window. There was a mailman standing next to her father, holding a picture of the governor and a tall gal in a fancy blue dress next to him. I saw people I recognized everywhere I looked. A man from the hardware store where Uncle D bought supplies, a teenage girl who sold papers at the interurban station, a boy who was always on his bright orange bicycle, and who was on it today.
The whole scene feels surreal. These ordinary people that she's seen in daily life who have revealed this kind of monstrous side. And it has such resonance today. I mean, as a white person with deep Midwestern roots myself, reading that, it's really hard not to think, what would I have been doing had I been a child or alive then?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I have often posed that question about myself, but also about my family. I don't know what they were doing that day. And
do you want to know?
You know, I don't know. Sure, if my grandmother was still with us, she's left us, and alas, I would ask her the question, and she would have spoken frankly about it. I'm quite sure.
But the thing is, your grandmother growing up there, she would have known people who did go to that lynching, and so now you don't know which people you might have met when you were growing up had attended it, and you don't know how that might have affected her relationships with them. It's so strange to think about how all of this can be forgotten, hushed up.
You know, there was an African-American community near Marion, Indiana, just a few miles away, called Weaver, Indiana. And I was really, when I read about this, I was really interested. I wanted to go visit. And so I went to what was supposed to be Weaver following Google Maps. And what I found was a crossroads with a sign that said, this is where Weaver was. And, you know, it's unbelievably powerful to me, potent as a symbol. Maybe it was people moving away for whatever reason, but it sure feels awfully linked to those events of August 7th, 1930, that over time, that just wouldn't be a tenable position to stay there.
I want to ask you to leave us with one more reading. It's a powerful one, but you were talking about the heat. And this is Calla remembering the events of that day, which really kind of never leave her.
She says, I kept hearing it in my head, keep hearing it, down the years and always banging at my door. And when it comes, when I'm thinking back, the devil hot, blister bright afternoon sky I'm driving through turns to black, and the air grows scorching ever hotter, and the corn silk's heads glow red with the heat of it, and they cackle and roar and move in their glowing thousands for the jail. I am in the crowd and above it, and the sheriff steps aside and they take their sledgehammers to the walls and beat their way in. Then they are pouring across the tile floors and past the iron doors and through the hallways of the big jail. And there I go pouring with them. And as we pour, there are shouts about God and about country and about honor and about truth and about death and death and death. And we pour up the stairs and find where they are holding the boys. I'm not dreaming, it's something I'm seeing. I'm there, and I tell them to stop. And I'm not alone in telling them. There are hundreds of us, thousands, many thousands, millions even, and the earth joins us, and the sky, and the moon, and the stars, and we say stop, but they do not stop. The first boy is beat to death right there, then dragged around, then hung from the bars on the cell window. Then one by one, they take the others. They drag them dead and about to be dead through the night, and the heat, and the roaring crowd, and the universe twitching to the killing trees.
Well, thank you. I just don't even know what to say after that. That passage, it's an extraordinary piece of writing, and it's overwhelming.
It kind of got to me, too, a little bit.
Yeah, thanks. Laird Hunt's new novel is called The Evening Road.